Kitties, we're here today because of a movie we promised.
Yeah.
For at least a week before Thanksgiving, before Thanksgiving is Hot Summer Nights.
Oh, yeah.
We're not even in the right season for it, but
This is an all-around season, but yeah, the movie does take place during the summer. Let's start off with, so you and I have been talking movies on a consistent basis since August, right? And this was number two on the list of movies that you told me, oh, you gotta see this movie. First one was Under the Silver Lake, and then soon after, Hot Summer Nights came in my window, and I took a look at the poster, and I read the synopsis, and I'm like, yeah, I can put this one on the back burner for a little bit, but I don't know. This is one of those movies that after watching it, I was shocked that I had not seen earlier because it was so good, start to finish. I love this movie. I'll let you introduce it. I know this one's close to home for you, and you've been obsessed with this, is what you
said. I have. I've probably watched it at least 15 times.
What?
Yes, and it's funny because I didn't even find this movie. It was my wife. She has this thing for Timothée Chalamet for some reason.
He's kind of a big deal.
He is a big deal.
You're
and he's a great
future
actor.
Batman for sure too. I think in 2040 timeline when he's in his 30s, we're talking about if he gets a haircut, we're talking about a young
That's half his power though, is that hair. you can't do it, man.
Yeah.
Girls
eventually
love that hair.
Eventually.
He's so skinny though, bro. Like I tell my wife dude,
he'll bulk up.
I guess so, but you know, he's an awesome actor. I will say everything he's in, he's fire.
Yeah.
And whether it's The King or Call Me By Your Name.
Lady Bird.
Lady Bird, he was even good in, even though he plays an asshole in that movie. But Hot Summer Nights, man, she told me, you know what, Philip, I think you'll like this movie. And I said, all right, I'll give it a shot.
So your wife saw this
She saw it
first.
Without me.
Wow.
Yes. Which is like, it's a blue
rarity,
moon.
Right?
Yeah, it's a very rare occasion. So I gave it a shot and I fucking loved it. Sorry if I'm cursing, but I have to say it. And I've been obsessed with it because, and I don't exactly know why, there's just a connection with it for me. And I think a lot of it has to do with the soundtrack, like you were saying, the cinematography. I like the characters. I think the acting is quite superb in it. But yeah, I promise I'm not an A24 fanboy because the last two movies I did suggest to you were A24.
Yeah, it's okay. I've got a couple of friends who are A24 fanboys and girls, and I'm starting to be on that train.
I appreciate what they do. They're bringing original stuff.
Ideas, and this day and age, they're kind of needed. They fit perfectly because the big budget stuff that Hollywood's cranking out and Disney and Netflix even to a certain degree, once in a while you want to take a break from.
I do have a bone to pick with A24 because both the movies that I really liked from them were not given the marketing that they deserved.
Yeah.
They seemed to like push it away. They didn't really, because this movie, it actually came out at South by Southwest. And so I guess people just didn't like it. I think that's kind of what, after my research, nobody seems to like this movie except for me and a couple of my friends that I've
actually gotten
to watch. Yeah, here you are.
I can see how it could be a polarizing movie, so I'll play devil's advocate for a second. If you didn't grow up in the 90s and if marijuana was not a part of your life at any point, this movie's going to rub you the wrong way, just flat out, plain and simple. So a lot of the folks with YouTube channels nowadays that just do movie reviews so that they can get likes and views, and they're 20-year-olds themselves, and, you know, good on them. They've stayed away from drugs and premarital sex and all that sort of stuff, and they're, for all intents and purposes, outstanding citizens. This movie's going to rub them the wrong way because it's early 1990s, coming of age.
1991, actually.
Teenager, yeah.
Because it's the hurricane marks that. This is the hurricane
that's right.
From The Perfect Storm, if you ever seen the movie.
Yeah.
This is the same hurricane off the coast, East Coast. This takes place, was it Massachusetts or something like that?
This takes place in Hyannis. Hyannis, Massachusetts, which is like a rich, posh sort of suburb of the Boston area. They go to Boston a couple of times in this movie for some
scenes. I think that's a part of my bias, too, because part of my growing up in the summers, I used to visit North Carolina, and it was very much like this. You definitely have the townies. You definitely have the summer birds, you know, that have these million-dollar houses on a private beach, and it looks almost exactly like this, you know? So I did feel a kinship to this movie, and that might be why I liked it so much. And I liked the... So a lot of people say that this movie is very cliche, which I can see that there is some cliche parts in it.
Well, there's line from Timothée Chalamet, yeah, where he's like, "You're sending me off to my grand. Is it his aunt's place?
Yeah, his aunt's.
His aunt's place for the summer. What a cliche. Yeah,
yeah. And so, I mean, there is parts to it, but the way they do it, I felt like was original. Like it didn't seem, it didn't feel like this was done over and over and over again. In fact, let's get to the beginning. So this is about a boy named Daniel Middleton, who his father just died, and they kind of go into this whole summary with an 8mm family camera, and you know, he's going through a lot. You know, he's even wearing the Daniel Sun 80s kind of a headband when you meet him, and his Linda Ronstadt's on, and he's kind of just going
he's
through
an innocent
depression.
Kid too, which is important at this point. Like, he's very very rigid and almost unemotional, to the degree that his dad's passing doesn't really even affect him on an emotional level.
Yeah. Well, I think it does, but it's not in the traditional way, because he does burn his dad's albums to kind of get over it. So there is something lurking in him, and I think that's what causes this whole
rebellion?
Rebellion, this catalyst to like do things, to live life.
Death can do that.
And risk it.
Yeah,
you know?
Death can do that for you.
Yeah, and that's what I think the story is about this great risks that he takes, and a lot of it pays off until it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And but in the beginning, so he gets sent off to his aunt, and you can see he's very lonely. He doesn't fit in. He's not a townie or a summer bird because he's not rich.
Yeah.
Summer birds are usually rich. And that's kind of where I was too when I was over there. I wasn't really a rich kid, but I kind of had relatives that were over there. So it's like
you
wasn't
had
really
place.
A summer bird.
Yeah, but if you
really.
Needed to be, you could flex. You could
yes,
flex that.
I wasn't where Daniel
to.
Was. Like,
I gotcha.
Daniel was completely alone, and you see him go to this party. But I certainly felt like that, like when I was growing up.
Sure.
As far as like coming out to Dallas-Fort Worth area for the first time and not knowing anybody.
Yeah, a whole new set of friends that you had to make, just environments that are foreign to you.
That party scene.
I've actually been through some very similar settings that Daniel... I don't know, how old is he in this movie? 17, 18?
I think he's 17,
okay.
Yeah.
I want to say I was a little bit older, 19, 20, and it was pretty much college freshman versus high school. But I've been in those party situations where, you know, you're invited by one person who you just met and you know absolutely no one there. And
it starts out, the Iceman cometh.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that scene. And I've actually had my drink knocked out of my hand before at a party like that. Like,
yeah, and you just got to let it happen.
Yeah. Nobody cares about you, and it's loud, and they're trying to get to know you, and they're like, eh.
Exactly.
You know, so it's like, I definitely feel that. And it might be cliche, you know, this whole thing, even who he is, but it feels good. It feels original.
It feels
while you're watching
natural.
It. Yeah, and the movie is quite spontaneous, I feel is the right word. Like it kind of jumps to things right away.
It's, interesting you mentioned that.
Yeah.
The opening sequence of we don't get the title credits till after the party, which is like at the 20-minute mark. The title
That's
credits
true.
Get slapped on the screen, Hot Summer Nights. And to be honest, that's when I knew I was in for a movie that I was going to really enjoy, because, seeing the title credits at the 20-minute mark and also the soundtrack building up, the outfield Use Your Love comes on as the party intro scene. And it's like Josie's been on vacation for a week, far away, not for a week. Sorry, I always get those two lyrics. But as soon as that hits and he's walking up to the door, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm in. Thank you for recommending this, Philip, because at this point I was completely enthralled with what I was watching on the screen, from the soundtrack to the style to the pink GTA Vice City style of the font.
Saved by the Bell 80s.
Saved by the Bell 80s mixed with like License to Drive. The poster of this movie, there's multiple posters and multiple sort of art promotion.
And I enjoyed that.
It's very 80s-ish.
It's painted like the old school way. And I even skipped a part. So the movie is actually narrated by a child, which I really appreciate, because
a younger child than
Daniel, but he's telling you a story about what happened in his neighborhood. You don't even actually meet the kid until the very end.
Yeah.
But I like it because it's like, this is based on a true story, kind of. And so you always get these kind of like urban legends, that kind of deal. And I love that kind of almost fairy tale feel, but it's not. It's kind of like magical realism. You know,
that may be because you're hearing it from a 13-year-old's point of view. Exactly. So he may be sort of mementoing the whole thing. And from the last scene that he saw, which we'll get to eventually, maybe he's trying to put the pieces to how everything got there through his version of it. That's one unique spin that you could take on the movie.
And they use the narrator like as a kind of catch up.
Yeah.
It's kind of telling you about the players and the play. The neighborhood, what's going on. Like they talk about like when you first meet Hunter Strawberry at the party, mm-hmm. and it's like there's this great line where he's like, oh, it was the hottest day in July or whatever, and Hunter was not sweating.
Yeah, right.
And he gives him a little wink as he's going by. So it's like,
he's
really
like the Chuck Norris or the Dosa Keys guy of the world.
James
Dean. The impenetrable sort of perfect figure. And
he's a very handsome dude.
Yeah, he's introduced. I don't know this actor's name. I do know
Alex
that he's
Rowe.
Alex Rowe. He's British. I've seen him. I want to say I've seen him in something else.
He was in The Fifth Wave.
That's why I forgot about him. Because that's with Chloe Moretz Grace, right?
Yes.
I think. Yeah. And
he's been in a couple of TV stuff. So he probably hasn't had that big of a career, but this movie I felt like was perfect for him because he looks so cool. He does look like James Dean coming in with his, you know, cool car to the party, and he's got all these chicks with him, and then the kids are talking about how like, oh, he had sex with the principal's daughter in the butt twice
they
or whatever.
They come up with all of these extreme situations that he's the focal point of. So this is where I had vibes, strong vibes of The Sandlot, just vibe-wise. I felt like Hunter Strawberry was like the Benny Rodriguez of this movie that everybody looked up to, and he was like the main leader of whatever clique he was a part of, whatever field he was a part of. But also, as the movie progresses, I do get the Smalls Benny relationship vibe between these two. The big brother that was never there. This is like if Benny Rodriguez started slanging weed, this is exactly what it would turn into, in my
just
opinion.
Just like, stick your glove up. I'll make sure it's there. No, I get it. And I do have like a soft spot for movies like that because a good chunk of my life actually happened that way. Where I actually befriended somebody that was actually super cool in like the fraternity.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm a fraternity guy. So, I mean,
it's interesting
what you do with what you will on that, okay? Whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing. But he was super cool. He took me under his wing, and I kind of was a little bit of a protege, I feel, a little bit, you know? So I have a soft spot for that. And there's another movie that reminds me of that. Probably not many people have seen this. It's Green Street Hooligans.
Yeah, with Elijah
Wood. So it's the same thing. He kind of gets this really cool, you know, big guy that kind of takes Elijah Wood under his wing, and they fight people.
Yeah.
They're soccer hooligans.
There's
you know?
A lot of mob movies that work like that, too. I mean, Goodfellas to a certain degree, but there's always like, In a lot of crime movies, there are the big bosses that sort of have their protégés under their wings, and we're, in the movies at least, we're sort of getting the point of view of the guy who's being introduced into that world, and he's got to navigate everything. And this is where Hot Summer Nights gets very intriguing, because at that party, Timothy Chalamet's character, Daniel Middleton, is introduced to marijuana for the first time, and in the back room, he hits the bong pretty hard.
Well, that's the second party.
Oh, that's the second party.
Yeah, so the first party, he just sees Hunter Strawberry.
And remember, that's right.
He's working at the gas station, and Hunter comes in.
Yeah, back up, Sash, just a second.
So Hunter comes in with weed, and he's like, hide this
because
there's a
cop. The
cop
is right on the outside. Okay.
So I love that part, and he makes the decision right then, and he hides it in the cash register of all places.
This is their bonding moment.
Yes. And so Hunter's just acting like he's, you know, looking at stuff in the convenience store. The cop comes in, gets a soda. He takes a real long glance at Hunter, and then he comes over, and you can feel Daniel like, oh shit. And then he buys a soda, and then he realizes, oh, the weed's in the cash register. So he gives the cop a free soda. And the cop's like, why? And he's like, it's hot.
This one's on me.
Yeah. And so they become friends, and that's how Hunter takes them to another party.
Yeah.
Where there's like dudes passed out from the weed that he's smoking.
Yeah, because the first party, we don't get the whole party vibe from it. We just get the introduction of Hunter Strawberry and how he's bigger than life and sort of the town hero, and all of this lore surrounds him. And then we see Daniel's summer job at the gas station, and mm-hmm. then a conflict there with the cop, and then the buddy sort of aspect to it yeah. begins taking shape. Okay.
Yeah, and I love the different... And I love the different takes on Hunter Strawberry when you go through and they ask all the people in town, like, oh, he rode his motorcycle 180 miles in an yeah. hour in the rain yeah. at night with lights.
Chuck Norris jokes.
Yeah. And then there's like his, you know, what did he say? The cop's like, oh, he's bad or whatever. Like, he's a criminal. So you see all the different perspectives of how he's kind of affected everybody's lives.
Then you start seeing the real guy a little bit as the movie progresses, and mm-hmm. I love that about this. So Second Party is where he gets introduced to the weed.
Yes.
And when he takes that bong rip pretty hard, bro. I don't know.
It's a long rip.
That was quite the rip. And he passes out off the bat, which I didn't even know there was weed strong enough in the 90s that could get you like that.
I will say I'm a little critical on that because weed in the 90s did not look like that.
Bro, yeah. It was just swag. So
let's be real. Yeah. If we're gonna do that 10-year photo challenge, yeah. let's do. We can do it with marijuana, man, and you'll see the big difference.
Yes,
but I love how they when he takes the rip, and you see the different flickers of cartoons and the actual atom bomb going off, and you see all these like snippets, almost like Oliver Stone-esque, you know, showing you that he's really high, and then he falls down, and it has that song by Rev Martin. That comes on, which is really cool. I didn't even know this song, but I'm into it now. Like, I downloaded the whole soundtrack, and I listened to it on the regular. Yeah, the
soundtrack, hard to find. It's, like, piecemealed together on YouTube.
Oh, definitely.
Because there's no official soundtrack that was released.
Yeah, and honestly, I haven't been able to find a lot of information on who the sound editor or the sound mixer or anything on that through, like, IMDb or something like that, because I wondered... The music selection seemed super personal, and I think it was probably the director's choice. Maybe had it in his mind.
It's definitely
the whole
time. Not 90s centric. I don't think any of this music, except for maybe Timmy T, One More Try, which is a pretty classic song. I think that's a 90s song, but everything else, like the outfield, there's a.
But it does. I do realize like they cap it. Like at a certain point. So they come, and that's how regular life is. You're going to hear the 50s and 60s music, like when he first meets his love interest, of course.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that it's just kind of hodgepodged together, and it just creates, for me, a cohesive thing with the music. Like
the music is very symbolic of what the main character or what the characters are going through in that specific scene. Like, it does encapsulate the tone of that specific scene very well. Like, there's the scene where he's introduced to Maika Monroe's character for the first time, and he drives her home, and then he sees her walking away, and one of those songs hits, and it's the perfect song for that moment.
50 song. So you know what I like about that, though, is that that they didn't seem to be like, oh, we can't play this, people won't, you know, get it. And they used it kind of like a Martin Scorsese way that he uses music, is to kind of date the time era. Like, you know, and you know, on the radio, they're going to be playing the old school stuff. And I really appreciated that, too, because when they go see the movies in the drive-in, they are the movies that would be playing. Like Terminator 2 was out that year. Yeah. What was the first one?
You know,
it wasn't
Terminator. For the first 60 minutes of this movie, I really thought that there was a sci-fi twist going on, and they were in like some weird time loop. I won't get too far into that, but it might have been a gaffe in the script, maybe. Because they end up watching T2 like 3 or 4 times, right?
Yeah.
In this film. And there's some dialogue about T2 before we even see them at the theater for the first time watching Terminator 2. He says, "I'll be back." So, and they make a joke about Terminator. I don't know. I felt like there was some weird time loop thing going on, but then that's just me.
Like, you have to think, remember back then, they didn't have streaming. They didn't have DVDs and stuff. VHS was probably like a... So if you wanted to watch Terminator 2, which was obviously the best movie at the time, I think, probably one of the best, they had to go see it multiple times. And not only that, usually when they're going to see it, the first time that they're watching it, and that's when Daniel has to take a pee, and that's the first time that they're watching it. But every other time... they're making out with their girls. So
that's
like,
true. They just took them back to something that they knew. Yeah, I got you.
I forget what he's watching at first, because it's not Terminator 2 when he meets Micah Monroe's character. It's something else. I forget, because that's when she gets out of the car in front of him. Which, honestly, this whole movie is kind of like a male fantasy. at to a certain point, like somebody who's introverted that would need somebody to unlock how who
do you,
they are.
Yeah, how do you get out of that that introversion sort of lifestyle? So before the Mike Monroe, the only important thing I want to touch on is that he has a one-on-one conversation with Hunter Strawberry, Daniel does, about the business opportunity and how he's going to spend his time during the summer. And and they basically they hit it off pretty quickly as like buddies, and Hunter sort of introduces him to the weed selling that he supplies the local kids with, and dime bags and nickel bags. And there's this cool scene where authenticity plays a big role in this movie for me as to why I enjoyed it so much, because they go through the pricing of the nickels, dimes, the eighth, and all that. And it was on point.
Okay, I don't know in the 90s, though. I think it's on point now, maybe.
Well, it was definitely on point for when I was a 20-year-old, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Shameful admission, but it's that part of my life is long gone. But it was authentic, and the conversation that was being had felt real, and that probably comes from the script writing. I'm sure Elijah...
Actually, that happens after he meets the Mike Monroe character, which is Michaela. So what happens is that like I said, it's very spontaneous. Like, it just jumps from one place. And a lot of the critics feel like they didn't like that. And I honestly, I'm okay with that. There's not very much fat to be trimmed off this movie. It just jumps into the next thing. So I like the kind of like the attention span. It's kind of like good for an ADD person if you are. Like,
yeah, it is goes all in the next one.
So he's in the drive-through, and Michael Monroe's character is mad at her date, and she gets out of the car in front of him while he's, you know, eating popcorn and drinking, and she gets in his car, and that's when the narrator comes in and tells you about her character and how like hot she is. Like, she's the neighborhood hottie, you know? And like, they go into like this, football player from another school, like, committed suicide after they broke up.
Yeah.
And she only dates these older guys.
Extreme stories to raise her up to this godliness, this goddess status in her local environment.
True to a child's viewpoint. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's very like mythical. Yes. Like, this is what's going on, which I love. I love that little touch.
Because that's kind of how, up to a certain point, until you actually experienced high school, that's kind of how the prom queen was portrayed in the 80s and 90s, and that sort of most popular girl in town, the whole Kelly Kapowski vibe to it. She was introduced as this, you know, off limits to everyone except whoever her boyfriend was, and too high of a status for anybody to really get to know, and if you did get to know her, she'd ruin your life, sort of high school girl.
Yeah, like, she's too good for you, man. Yeah. Like, you can't ever like handle a woman like that. She's
exactly.
She's on fire.
And that's another thing of this movie that I really love, is that we're drug along the sort of illusion of how a 13-year-old narrator, and a lot of critics of this film didn't understand the narrator and didn't understand the place of this 13-year-old telling the story.
True.
But that's the point, is that a 13-year-old's view of what's going on in the world is very it's sensationalized to a certain degree, because none of these characters all the way meet the sort of template that this boy is giving us a rundown of. Hunter Strawberry is not like, he has his weaknesses, he has his his shortcomings. Maika Monroe's character, who is Michaela, right? It's very similar to her acting name, so I get it confused. But she's a strawberry as well. So
we find that out in the conversation you were talking about. So after, but let's go back to the car. So she gets in his car, and then I guess you would call him a yuppie. I don't know if that's a bad term. I don't really know. I guess he's kind of like a preppy kind of guy.
Side note, I would have loved to have heard, "Who's gonna drive you home tonight?" At this point,
but I love that.
I didn't make the sound decisions for this film.
So he's like yelling at her. He's like, "Oh, you're a river rat," and things like that. And
yeah, one of the yuppie kids is yelling at Michaela.
Yeah, and she's like, "Or we could just stay," and because he's surprised. I feel like Daniel's reaction to a lot of things is probably how you would actually react in situations like that. No matter how good you might think you're in that situation, that's a big surprise. If the hottest girl in the whole neighborhood jumps into your car and you're just like in awe and you're high and you're watching a movie, and then she's like, or you can just stay. And then he just books it.
Yeah, right.
And when they're on their way home, I love this joke because he's like trying to make a conversation with her and he's not good. He's not like a ladies' man.
Not yet. No,
nope. Not yet. He doesn't have the confidence yet, but he tells her, he's like, he looked like a real asshole. And she's like, what makes you think you don't even know him? What makes you think that?
The raisinettes.
Yeah. He's like, raisinettes. He's
yeah.
Like, the food of assholes. I was like,
That was another line in this movie that doubled with the soundtrack and just the whole vibe, where I knew that I was in for, I won't say a classic, but at least an underrated movie that I could recommend to everyone that is into this sort of movie. Like, I knew I was into something different than what's out right now. It set it apart from the class. It was just that little note about raisinettes. It's yeah. It's little lines and scenes and songs that really make movies stand out. Because
I'm starting to think all those reviewers were raisinette guys.
Raisinette like, guys are 20-year-olds who just haven't been through life yet and can't relate to any of what is going on in this movie.
No offense if you like raisinettes, but
my mom likes raisinettes.
I'm not the kind of guy that eats raisinettes at the movie theater. They're overpriced. Right. Who wants to eat
$4 for a box of raisinettes or for any candy at a movie theater for that?
I mean, and you know they're being bought. They're still in play. Like because you know some of the things have been like when you go to the theater, you're not going to see the hot tamales anymore, candy. You know, there's certain things that have been phased out, but raisinettes
are still there. Yeah. Twizzlers are still there.
I don't understand the licorice thing. I'm not a big licorice guy.
Same here.
I feel like that was
I'm more of a Red Vines kind of guy.
Red Vines. I don't know.
Those are the big tubs of licorice that they were very Twizzler like, but they were different consistency, different texture.
I know what you're talking
they
about.
They were chewier. I go with those.
Yeah. Those are the ones that Wayne's World has in his car. Yes. And kind of chops off. But like, I never understood licorice because I always felt like that was the candy that the Little House on the Prairie people ate. Like, that's what they made in the snow.
It is a very
know?
Primitive candy.
It's old, you know, and I'm not into it, to be honest. I'm a chocolate guy. What can I say? But not raisinettes.
Not raisinettes?
Not raisinettes, no, man.
What about yogurt raisins?
Those are dope. I'm not going to lie.
So there's not much of a difference.
No,
it's just chocolate.
No.
Chocolate versus yogurt over the raisins, the only difference.
No, but
here.
Usually the yogurt raisins are like accompanied with a trail mix or something. So it kind of is like a
sweet. So you
like
can't do yogurt
sweet,
raisins by themselves?
No, man. You can't. That's like eating Lucky Charms with nothing but marshmallows in it. Like, I did that before.
My 3-year-old seems to love that.
I did that once. I separated. And one time when I was a kid, I separated the red balloons and the purple horseshoes. Yeah. And I ate a whole bowl of red balloons once. And I just couldn't do it after that anymore. So I learned my lesson.
Daniel is definitely right about 1990s teenagers and young adults. If you were eating raisinettes in that time, you on a consistent basis, odds are you were a douchebag.
Yeah. And then he tells a joke because when they park at her house, I guess they give this feeling that she doesn't want to go in. Like, she stays in the car. And he
picks up on it.
Yeah, and so he tries to tell her a joke, which he's very bad at. He has to, like, backtrack.
Not a funny joke.
He completely messes it up, honestly. Yeah.
But
the punchline
endearing.
Right away.
It's endearing to women, and that's what a lot of, at least...
And men, too, I
in
think.
In your youth, a lot of girls in high school and college, I came to learn this too late, were endeared by, you know, your vulnerability and your shortcomings and where you failed, because... It's nice to see that the women see at a young age, at least they see the machismo left and right. They see the trying to impress you left and right. So it's a nice breath of fresh air to hear a bad joke every once in a while. And he plays it off very well. And he's very real about just how, innocent he is.
But he
to
tries.
A certain degree.
And, you know, and honestly, I think that comes into her character because she is a little bit. I think an older soul, like she's lived through
a lot.
She's
nothing like the 13-year-old kid is making her out to be.
Yeah, she's kind of worldly. Like, she's dating older guys. She comes from a bad household. Her brother was selling drugs. Her mom dies. So she's definitely older, like
seasoned.
More mature. Mm-hmm. Seasoned is a good word because I think younger peoples, men and women, they may be fooled by that bravado or that kind of like false confident thing, you know. But I think she's at a place where she's tired of that. She's seen a lot of these guys that are confident from their money or whatever, their looks.
They're a dime a dozen.
Yes, exactly. And she kind of likes this
out of town introvert. Weird.
Yeah.
This is a bit of a cliche. For 80s movies and 90s movies, this is a little bit of a cliche because, yeah, she's the hot girl getting to know the nerdy kid who's from out of town and new to the city. And she falls for it every time.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It's cool. I think because a lot of us guys are kind of like that. I try to explain that to people is that guys, not a lot of guys are truly confident. I think there's a theory that the top 10% guys get all the women or something like that.
Right.
So there's like all these other guys that have a real hard time talking to women, like Daniel. And so I think that really
especially nowadays
connects with us. Yeah.
That's a different animal, though. Yeah. Meandering.
We'll get into that. So, you know, I think that's common ground that we can all feel because, you know, I didn't really kind of connect with Daniel with his father figure dying. I felt for him, you know. But I did feel his out of placeness, his, you know, nerdiness, his not confidence when you're an early, young person growing up, trying to figure things out. And, you know, kind of like you want to be with this girl, but you don't know how. And so I love that. And he kind of makes her laugh. And so I'm not even really into Micah Monroe. I'm not really attracted to her, but in this movie, she is attractive.
She is
by her
and
personality.
While she portrays a high school girl, she's like 28, 29 when she's actually making this movie. So she can
was she?
Gosh, yeah.
Because this was 2 years ago, so 2017.
I
want to
say, well, she was in It Follows much earlier on in the decade. I want to say she's 25 or 26 when she's making this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she could kind of, I mean, you can suspend, you know, reality a little bit by kind of, I mean, Timothée Chalamet does look like a young guy because he's so skinny and he's got like an innocent
face. Frailness to him.
Yeah. So, I mean, Hunter Strawberry does not look like a high school student. He looks like a grown man.
Yeah. He looks like a grown ass man.
Yeah.
And he needs to, I think, because he is the big brother role in this movie that for the entire duration sort of keeps Timothée Chalamet's character in check and not to keeps him under control because that mentor aspect is there the whole time until it's not and until Daniel wants a little bit more. And yeah, that's why the first half of this movie is it's sort of like
it's a fantasy.
I wish it would have almost stayed there and I would have two variations of the movie because once they get their whole side hustle, well, it's not really a side hustle, it's a summer hustle. Once they get that down pat and figured out, Daniel's character begins to evolve and the coming of age and sort of like the latching on to this idea that he wants to rise in power maybe so I'm going too far with it as far as the ascension to power and control but
we'll get there because I think that's a part of the reason why a lot of people didn't like the movie because there's a lot of confusion on the third act, I feel. So I think that is that can put off on a lot of people, but let's go back to after the Micah Monroe character. Like, he even asks her name, and she doesn't give it to him. She kind of just smiles and walks off.
And we don't know that they're brother and sister quite yet.
Yes, until the conversation. And so it's right after that. He's having a conversation with Hunter Strawberry on the beach, and he's telling him about this girl that he met. And he gives him this one detail, like, oh, she has black fingernails. And that's what Hunter
sets
realizes. And but before he can say that, he says, hey, I would like to get into this weed game. And he's like, oh, you better not be doing this for a girl. But he says bad words and stuff. But anyways, so he does want to get into it and he does. But then he says, you need to leave that girl alone. She's my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, crap. So
and
he
we
agrees.
Find out that they're somewhat estranged from one another because Hunter, you know, couldn't handle the passing of their mom. And he sort of.
Well, it was actually because the mom asked him to stop dealing drugs and he didn't.
Yes.
And that's why Michaela's character and Micah Monroe's character cannot forgive him.
But then she passed and he couldn't handle it. So he just sort of removed himself from that family unit and he became the town drug dealer.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of things that are up in the air because they give you these like these little clues. Like when Micah Monroe's character doesn't want to go into the house, like, is she being sexually abused or something? Because, like, it doesn't seem like he's overbearing or nothing. He just seems...
We don't get a lot of the dad in this movie, but no, it's none of that. It's just sort of... She wants to escape too. That house isn't what it was before. It's not a family unit anymore. So she's saving up cash, keep in mind to jet out of town as soon as she can. So we're introduced to. So now we have three characters down. We've got Daniel, we've got Hunter Strawberry, and Michaela Strawberry. Yes. And so
Daniel has another conversation with Hunter.
He's attached to both of these brother. Attached to the brother and sister very close. He's infatuated with both of them to a certain degree, like his best friend, mentor sort of figure. In a very short amount of time is this Hunter kid, and his love interest in this new town is Hunter's sister. Mm. So I'm just speaking from personal reference here. I have actually been in these shoes before.
Ooh.
Okay, so here we go down this road. There may be some editing required for this one, but anyways, coming out of high school, me and a buddy of mine who were routinely engaged in basketball, hanging out, and even a little bit of smoking weed, we got to know each other very closely and became very good friends. And one day he invited me over to his house and I met his sister, and we could not prevent what occurred from that point forward. And I had to balance the best friend and sister thing.
Did it end well?
It did, because okay. And this is to my friend's credit. He understood what was happening, and he understood who I was, and knew that I wasn't in this for the wrong reasons. And it ended up being my first long term relationship. And to this day, me and my buddy still get along great, and have
that's a good guy, man.
It is a good guy, and
probably better than most of us, man. I'm sorry, but you
probably better than me at the time. But
you would have caught a beating by a lot of other guys.
So this is where my resonance with Daniel's character really... Okay, I'm watching this kid, and granted, he's a little younger than I was when I was going through this, maybe by 2 or 3 years, but minus the actual drug dealing, because I never did that.
Same.
Everything else, tit for tat. I didn't experience this on a summer vacation or to where I was removed from my daily environment, but... A lot of this is coming of age with me as well, so I can't not like this movie, because shades of his character are shades of myself from 15, 20 years ago. And I haven't seen that in a lot of movies today. And for it to get pulled off in 2017, sorry.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive. And
I enjoyed that, yeah. And when they have that talk, he has another talk, because the thing about... Daniel is that he seems to be pretty business savvy. Like, yes. He kind of tells him, like, well, why don't you sell more of these ounces instead of these dime bags? And he's like, well, I would if I could. And he's like, oh, sorry for the dog. We're taking care of my friend's dog. So if you hear barking in the background, not bad.
Deep bass.
Yeah. But I love that part where he's like, you're too smart for your own good. And that's the truth. It's absolutely, he is too smart for his own good, because in doing so, he makes he kind of goes and makes a plan to get with a distributor, and he goes to this party, like, totally naive, and he asks this guy for pounds of weed at his party, and this dude is obviously like, what the hell? Like, you don't just, like, he's...
Oh, this is back in Boston, right? This is when they go to the... I don't
know if they go to Boston, but they definitely meet at another party. Like, he takes Hunter with him, and he tells Hunter to stay in the car.
Oh, yeah, this is in Boston. This is in the big city. So they make an hour or so drive out of from the Hyannis area, and they go back to downtown Boston and a strange party that you can tell is an escalated environment in tone, because there's some other drug usage going on.
Much more gangster vibe.
Yeah, much more adult gangster sort of serious tone. And then you've got these two out-of-town kids who are in that environment, and they stand out like a sore thumb.
Well, it's just him, because Hunter stays in the car.
That's right. Hunter stays in the car, and Daniel thinks at this point that he can handle the situation, and this is where you get a sense for this kid's in over his head a little bit. But it's a movie, it's a movie, so let's see where it goes. And they get into a physical sort of verbal altercation, and then here comes Hunter to save the day. Yeah. And this is where he stamps his seal as like the, being the protector and sort of the guide for Daniel's character throughout the rest of this movie. It is a violent scene.
This is about
at the 45 minute mark of the movie, I want to say. So it's when they're getting their game up and they're like, their hustle's taking a serious turn, because we're talking about pounds of weed versus nickel bags and dime bags. Mm-hmm. trying to elevate their game for the summertime. I understand.
And I love even the side characters, because even the guy that plays this drug dealer that he goes, he's like, oh well, my cousin didn't tell you like I was coming. He's like, no. And then he's like, he pulls out a gun out of his pocket, and he's like, who do you think I am? You know, he's gets kind of racist. Run like, I'm not one of those Filipino monkeys.
Yeah, up on me at my own party and ask me for pounds of weed. Yeah. And
what are you, a narc or something? Like, yeah, exactly. It's like, totally, that's not what you would do.
Yes.
And because he's up for selling him a dime bag. It's like, oh, you want some weed? You want a party, huh? Lots of bitches around here. Like, he's, the way that guy comes off, it's like, I've seen a guy like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's very reminiscent of what I've seen in neighborhoods like that. And he pulls out that gun, and it just takes... like Hunter comes out of nowhere and just smashes like a vase over his head or something, and he takes the gun and just beats this guy. Blood is splattered all over Timothy Chalamet's face and the walls, and he just continues to beat him, and it's super violent.
Yeah.
It just, and
it sets the tone very early on for what this movie could do. Because up to that point, and specifically with that beatdown scene, I was like, is this really happening, or is this sort of a fantasy of like, are they going to zoom back out to the car and then they're going to both walk in together and handle it differently? So I didn't know if that beatdown actually happened, but what it did actually happen, spoiler alerts. So you'll enjoy this conversation a lot more if you guys see it. And if you see this movie, highly recommended to everyone. But what that scene did for me is that it set the bar for like how extreme the movie could go, and I like that actually a little bit.
It wakes you up from the fantasy.
Yeah, it wakes you up from the humdrumness of the summer vacation and the innocence of selling dime bags and nickel bags. There is another character we're introduced to before all of this. That's the Thomas Jane.
Oh yes, the
town
sheriff.
Thomas Jane's really good. He played the Punisher in arguably what I think are the best renditions of the Punisher, or at least the first one with John Travolta as a bad guy. Anyway, Thomas Jane's a cool actor. Yeah, he played Howard Saint.
Is that the one where he's living in that apartment and all the people come together?
Kevin Nash
that
is
one's,
in it
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that one's the best one.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, and that's where you get the title of the movie, where he's like on a hot... Oh, no, wait, actually Dex says it. So we'll get into that too.
Well, what the cop... What Thomas Jane's character does is, one, we'll reveal who he really is here in a second once we get to another introduction of the character. Yeah. He's got his eyes on Hunter Strawberry and what he's doing, because this is 90s weed selling. So this is not 2019 kids, you know, slanging nickel bags and nobody really cares. This was a Class A felony.
It still is in many places.
In many places, but especially the Northeast at that point in time, they're kind of the slowest ones to get to become okay with this sort of stuff because of the tradition. Like, if you look at the scope of the U.S., it's like the West Coast is the more accepting, liberal, and the East Coast
probably more
is
hippies.
The more,
and East Coast is more preppy, like tennis players, either on their yachts, eating oysters
exactly.
and getting high. So it's like, it's total hypocrisy, because all these rich people, and you know it's true, you know people are getting high.
They're the ones getting away with it, but the people supplying it are the ones under the eye of
the
law.
The poor townies.
Yes, the poor townies are the ones who can be put in jail for long periods of time, and sadly, you've got a lot of folks who are serving sentences for drug distribution. I say sadly, but I mean like the marijuana distribution from the 90s that would get you 20 to 30 years in prison, which is a little steep of a price nowadays when we're talking about something that in the next 2 years is probably going to be recreationally legal everywhere.
Yeah, most places, it's a lot of places it already is. So, I mean, it's incredibly crazy that it was like up there with heroin, like it's in cocaine. Yeah. It's not on the same level. So,
well, alcohol went through its prohibition period too. Marijuana did as well, because you got to afford the government enough time to figure out how it's going to make the most money off of all this.
It's already making a lot of money as in this movie. So, so we are introduced to Tom Jane. He has his eye on Timothy Chalamet, and he's
and Hunter. Yeah,
but that moment, that's when his character starts freaking out, and this is a great scene because we skip this. They have a conversation like at a fair, or not a fair, but it's like a amusement park, kind of like with there's like a bumper cars in the back.
Oh yeah, and there's the fight in the back. Yeah.
And I love that because it's like this Citizen Kane-esque, like you're looking at the guy in the back window of like, you know, where the kid is sliding, and you're kind of like focused on the fight, but it's also a metaphor of the what's dialogue. Going on between the dialogues, because he's like, I'm not going to get butt raped in the thing. He's like totally freaked out. He's like, no, it's cool. I got this under control.
Yeah.
And so it does escalate. And so since we're at this part, at that part, it jumps to another scene, like right after that. Right. And I forget what the scene is. Exactly.
Blank. Wait, so after the amusement park, isn't that the scene where he drives off on his own and Thomas Jane pulls him over?
No, that's actually before, because freaked out about the sheriff.
Okay.
Interrogating him.
Well, then they go pick up or they go try to get more weed from the Boston party.
No, the Boston party...
See, this may be maybe this is a valid criticism of the movie, because the scenes do feel they're very hard to.
It's you've ADD, seen the movie like 15 times. Spontaneous. I've seen it like a lot, and what happens afterwards? So after that, they have the conversation about that.
Yeah.
The Chalamet character, Danny. Because he changes his name to Danny because tell him that it's cooler.
My friends call me Danny. Yeah. Hunter says, I'm going to call you Danny from this point on. And then he runs with it, and he introduces himself as Danny without saying
But Michaela doesn't like that, so she calls him Daniel. But he meets her again at the pharmacy, and she's looking for Epsom salt to put on the slide. Scene. Yes, which is great, honestly.
Yeah, it's cute.
The lollipop where he's got it in, and he's seen her, and he kind of like... bat something off the shelf so she would look his way.
Notice, yeah. I mean, we've all been there and done that.
It's so like bad, like what he's trying to do. But
I'm telling you, man, there's a lot of resonance with this character for me. Where in early college, I was positioning myself to be noticed by the girl that I wanted to notice me, and I'm like looking back at it. Yeah, I had to play it cool at the same time. So we shared a classroom together, and she was not a sister of any of my closest friends. So okay.
That's good.
So I'm just gonna dive into this one because this movie brought back these emotions and these feelings, and this is why I love this movie so much. It is a college version of The Sandlot for me. But anyways,
me too. College version.
Yeah, college real version of Sandlot. Like
what happened
if
college
the kids.
For me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm like college version. They were in high school. Apparently, they're in high school, but like it just feels more college.
It does feel more college. Yeah. So in college, there was this girl I was really into. We shared two or three classes unintentionally, and I was like, why am I seeing this girl everywhere that I'm at? We sat different in different rows from one another, and they were lecture hall classes. So over time, I was like, well, you know, I'm gonna sit a little bit closer today. I'm gonna sit a little bit and I would once we were out of these classes, I would just sit down outside of the room. I was going to UTA. I would sit down outside of lecture hall, and I would read some of the study material that I needed to get ready for my next class outside. And then eventually I would notice that the girl that I was sitting close to in class was sitting close to me outside as well, doing the same thing. So then I sort of positioned myself to make her notice that I was doing that. And maybe she already did, and that's why she started sitting there in the first place. But anyways, that's how we hit it off, was that these little things that I wasn't apt to. Yeah, the run-ins. I started noticing a little bit more, and so I would then knock... I wasn't knocking stuff off pharmacy shelves, but I would position myself to where it was going to be unavoidable that we would have a conversation. Some people say that's stalkerish, but some people would say I feel like I was just capitalizing on what was already happening, and I was picking up on it. So
I get you. And she takes control of the scene. Like, she takes the lollipop out of his mouth and puts it in her mouth and then puts it back into his mouth.
She wants to get to know him a little bit more. Yeah. And he's still at the point where he's not out of his shell fully to know and capitalize on that.
Well, she has this mystique, too, this way about her, you know, because she doesn't give him all the information he's looking for every time he asks. Because, like, first off, she's like, oh, I'm looking for Epsom salt. And he's like, why? And she's like, well, have you ever put Epsom salt on a slide?
Because it's
like
slug. Makes you
on a slug.
Yeah. slug.
Really?
Bro.
I thought it was a slide.
Not a slug.
I can't understand what
you've
they're
saying. You've seen this movie 15 times.
I know. I thought it was a slide because I thought it makes it more slippery.
No, it's a slug because it makes it dissolve into goo.
I thought it was, you could just put salt in, regular salt.
But in the 90s, maybe it was Epsom salt.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that if you don't know what Epsom salt is, you put it in water and you get
put
in
your
it.
Feet
so,
in.
Yeah, or your, whole, or your body. Whole body. I would do it after when I did a half marathon. Uh-huh. I put Epsom salt in my bath.
Nice.
And I just sat there for like 2 hours.
I've only bought Epsom salt for my wife when she wants like a relaxing foot sort of thing, and I'm not willing to rub her feet for 2.5 hours. Epsom
right.
salt
okay.
to the
All
rescue.
Right. But then, and when they're parting, he's like, oh, are you going to the fireworks?
Oh, yeah.
And she's like,
another Sandlot moment.
Maybe. You know?
Another Sandlot
moment.
Oh, so
yeah, that part is kind of sound like the
Very
fireworks
Sandlot-y.
Moment. So,
yes.
Yeah, so he doesn't know, like, if she's going to be there. She kind of, like, leaves it up in the air. But, I mean, she's going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, but she's still got this mystique. Like, she's not giving him everything that he wants. And
yeah, she's playing hard to get as an early college, late high school girl plays hard to get.
Hard to get, but also, like, I want you.
Leading on.
The same, yes. Because the whole,
lollipop.
Lollipop scene was like, that really taking control of the situation.
Sure, absolutely.
And so he's like, maybe we can share another lollipop. And he's like, she's like, you wish.
Which, hey, points on him. I don't think if I was in that situation, I'd have had the wherewithal to spit out that game after that just happened. I would have just been frozen in time like he was.
Yeah.
But then he had the ability to spit out that, you know, maybe we could share another lollipop line. Oh, bro. I mean, and that this movie taps into that a lot. It taps into the stuff that high school and college girls, when you're in high school and college, want to hear. It's that sort of like that suaveness of conversation, that back and forth. It's not all about the machismo. It's not all about the muscles and the jockiness and the stature in the school. The girls like Michaela who get the bad rep from the onlookers, but are really going through some shit and are smart and very, like you said at the start of this, old soul type of younger girls. They want to hear that mature sort of, and that's probably why Saved by the Bell type girls, like Kelly Kapowski ends up dating Jeff, the guy who runs the Max, and he's like 35.
Oh,
that's probably tapping into why the senior girl in high school having the college boyfriend sort of vibe.
They want something different.
Yeah, they want something mature.
Yeah, and I really like this whole thing because I think with Michaela and Hunter Strawberry's stories, and I think it gets... if you watch it only once, there's a lot of things you can just like not see. You know?
Yeah.
So with them, it's, I think what Daniel gives them is that he is just super personable. He sees them as he's taking them, because I think there's a lot of stories going on about them and they feel like they're misunderstood.
Yes.
There's all these stories. And so like
small town stories.
Yeah. And I think that's why Hunter really likes him, because even in a scene later, he's like, you and her are the only ones that take me for who I am. Because everybody else just thinks I'm a bad person or I just screw around and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's like...
You were worried we wouldn't have enough to talk about.
I know, man.
We're not even at the halfway point of the
movie. Oh, my God, I'm sorry.
We haven't even been introduced to one of my favorite characters in the film, period, which is you got
to
have an antagonist in all of this.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he's the antagonist because I want to like the guy, too. I do like the guy.
He's so charismatic, man.
He's very charismatic. He reminds me of like a dramatic Danny McBride sort of character who's taken himself seriously.
The actor's name is Emery Cohen, and his name in the thing is called in the movie is Dex.
Dex,
and so it's literally the scene right after the pharmacy, because he's walking home, and this black van is like
abducts him.
Yeah, and they're like barking at him,
and Hunter Strawberry's in the van looking all like kidnapped, basically.
Yes, and
but it turns out that these are just the suppliers for that next stage.
They got the message
in the deal. Yeah, we've been watching you guys, and then you get this whole very Goodfellas-esque sort of vibe, a diner scene, which is one of the better scenes in the movie.
It's because of Dex, man.
Yeah, it's because
he's just so cool, calm, and collected, like the whole way. Because he gets out of the car and he's like, come on, come with me. He's like, don't worry. If I wanted to hurt you, you'd be hurt
already.
Yeah. And he's like, I'm not asking.
He sets the tone very quickly for
he doesn't
who
get
he
upset.
Is.
He's very, and that's what makes him more scary, is that he is not getting upset. Even so, when they're in the diner scene, And he's telling him, like, that kid that you beat up, he drinks out of a straw now, you know, like, yeah. And all this stuff. And I guess that he was supplying that guy, and he's been watching them for a long time. Yeah. He's like, if you guys want to do this, let's do this. And so even when Daniel interrupts him and all this stuff, he doesn't really get out of bent out of shape.
No.
Even Hunter, like, bashes the table and gets up. And he's like, sit down.
He's very stoic.
Please sit down.
Very stoic and very commanding of the situation that he's in, because he knows that he has command over the situation he's in. He's the gateway to this next step that these kids want to take. Yeah. And he knows that he has the authority over them because, I mean, he's probably been there in their shoes, for that matter.
I just think he's seen a lot more, and okay. These kids does not pose a threat to him.
I would love to see a Dex movie, period.
I would too.
Elijah Bynum, if you're listening to this, the director of this movie, props. This is a
hell of a...
And he wrote it too, and you could tell a lot of this is probably coming from his personal experience or the stories that he had as a kid. If you want to, man, let's put a Dex movie out there, yeah. Man.
And actually, that is the truth. I watched a lot of interviews with these guys because there's not much information about this movie out there.
Yeah.
Like, I really do feel like A24 was like,
this might be
trying
it.
To put
it
in
this
the basement.
Episode of the Film Room.
Yes.
Is easily the
most content.
The
so
most
far.
Content already. Yeah. Already at the hour and 20 minute mark, we've pretty much put all the YouTube shit you can get together in one fell swoop. But that's what we do here.
Yeah. And I really enjoyed this. And the Dex part, when he gets the waffles.
Yeah.
The way he eats it, and he like licks syrup, the side of the
way he
mouth.
Pours the syrup, and he does it in a circle. He's like, I'm not bothered by
what they're trying to ask.
I'm not,
he's like, oh, what is
yeah,
that?
Yeah. What you want is not on my priority list. It's not at the top. I'm your gateway to everything that you want. So we're going to take this at my pace, and I'm going to drizzle this syrup over the waffles, and I'm going to enjoy every bite, and I'm going to let you know that you know you're not that important to what's going on in my business, but we can both help each other out at the same time. And that's what a drug czar kind of needs to do. That's what a supplier needs to do, is they need to set that tone. I'm not saying I've been there and done that, but I haven't. But that's what they need. I've seen enough gangster movies to know.
It's what you would expect in real life, yeah. Like somebody who commands that kind of power.
But then again, he might have just seen one too many gangster movies. He might be the guy who watches Scarface every month out of a religious sort of
maybe.
Experience.
But what I love about his character too is the way he looks, the haircut,
yeah.
That leather jacket. We all knew somebody in the 90s
that
wore that leather jacket.
Yeah,
and the
no-shave November mustache.
Yeah, yep. It looks so authentic. Like, I've known an uncle that looked like that even today. He like will not give up that look, and it's coming back around. 90s, early 90s looks are coming
very
back around.
Danny McBride foot fist way, if you've seen that movie,
with no mullet.
Yeah, with no
like,
mullet.
It's like a Caesar haircut or something, the forward, like the I don't know, it's a straight line in the front. It's just,
yeah, this guy's a scene stealer though, man. Every scene he's in is his, and I think that bleeds perfectly into the tone of the movie, because he's sort of, well, up until we get to, there's so much to get to.
And he's got a guy with him, and he's like, what's your boyfriend do? And he's like, oh, that guy, you know, he drives me around and occasionally hurts some people.
Yeah.
But that's another story. And
this
and
older, like 55-year-old bald guy who's just, you could tell he's just the muscle. He's the
Breaking Bad
attitude muscle.
The Breaking Bad. What's that guy? The one that killed everybody. Is it Mike or something like that?
Oh, I've never seen Breaking Bad.
Okay. Well, for the people that have, they probably know.
Everybody.
That's what it reminds me of, because he's bald and old, and he's like, he looks like he takes care of stuff. So, but even so, you start seeing the branching off of the two friends.
Yes.
You see Daniel wanting to get into this.
Hyper focused on the business aspect.
Yeah, but he's naively getting into it, and Hunter knows. I think, like, I want to get into the end, because I think Hunter knew at this moment, and that's why he didn't want to do it. He knew that this is not going to end well.
So
like, once you're in, you're in. You can't get out.
This is the part of the movie where we can accelerate at least the drug dealing aspect of the whole film, which is the crux of this movie as far as the plot is concerned. We can accelerate it a little bit because they do it themselves. In the next like 10 minutes, we're sort of seen, we're given a scene-by-scene sort of escalation
like
as to what this meeting with with Dex has resulted in, and now they're getting fronted pounds.
Yes, and even Dex is like, "Can you handle two?" And then he's like, "I want five,
five, ten." And then
and Hunter's like, "Dude,
you
and,
see the money machine? You see, well, you see Daniel shoveling money on his bed."
Yeah, actually, the first scene right after that is mm-hmm. this slow motion scene, and then the narrator kicks in again, filling you in on this wild bandana wearing cousin of Daniel's or something that he knew. And he's running down the street and he's like crazy. He's like, "What are you running from?" He's like, "I don't know." And then the cops pass him.
Oh, yeah. We're introduced to a very minor character who's like the third team member of this whole.
Yeah. Well, they're no longer selling to people. They're selling to other suppliers that are going to sell to people. So they're separating themselves from the aspect of selling dime bags. They are selling pounds to people. And so their whole job is to find people
buyers.
Big buyers. And so they successfully do that with the help of this guy because he knows so many people. And so he's kind of like the bridge for other neighborhoods. And so Hunter's got his neighborhood. And so it's like they start making a ton of money. It's a montage.
Official. Yeah. It's official. And the montage is great.
Yeah, because it has that song that, I always think of, why do I always think of Ninja Turtles or like Surf Ninjas? You remember those movies around that time? Yeah.
You know, I met Ernie Reyes Jr. at a dinner when I was like eight. And this is a rando story.
Yes, let's go into it.
I think it was like, I don't even remember why I was at this restaurant, but I'm sitting with my dad, I want to say, or stepdad, mm-hmm. and just out of the corner of my eye, Ernie Reyes Jr. is chilling, and I'm like... I just saw Surf Ninjas and Ernie Reyes Jr.'s there. So at the time, I was like, oh, man, big movie star. And I mean, still to this day, Ernie Reyes is cool. But yeah, I got him to sign. It was random. I think I got him to sign like a baseball card.
Oh, a baseball card.
I had nothing on me that was Ernie Reyes like representative. What would I have on me? Game Gear, bro.
You need him to sign the Game Gear from Surf Ninjas because that's what they use.
Oh, no, it wasn't a baseball card. It was a napkin. That's it, because I had nothing on me. I was at a dinner.
Do you still have it?
I'm 9 years old. It's somewhere in my parents' stuff. Yeah.
They threw it
away. But anyways, that's my Surf Ninja story.
So, they have this whole montage. They're making so much money. And, even Hunter Strawberry is like, oh, shit. There's so much money.
Like, this kid was right.
Yeah, he was. He buys a Corvette.
Yeah, he gets the Corvette. And now the police is even more scrutinous of this. Unless you want to talk about something in between then and now, or in between then and what I'm going to get to, let me know. Interrupt me if you do. I want to talk about the introduction to the softer side of Hunter Strawberry.
No, that's exactly what comes next, actually.
So he's in a diner.
He finds a girl that's different for him.
Yeah, but up to that point, all of the stories could have just been stories because we don't see Hunter Strawberry with any girls.
Well, I guess we assume because, one of the stories that they all agree on is like, I heard he killed a man. He killed a man. All the kids.
But he's just a gas station, he's a gas station mechanic.
Yes, but I guess we assume it because he beats the crap out of that kid. Like, you're okay, like,
so
oh,
he does have this sort
maybe
of...
Maybe he does fulfill it. A little bit, at least. So you kind of get
but we don't get the womanizer side. I think that was.
Well, they show him with a woman, and then they show that he's had sex with this guy that he's has sex with this guy's daughter that he's selling weed to during one of the explanations. So you kind of get this feeling that around. Okay, I mean, he's a good looking guy.
I gotcha.
So he probably does clean up. Okay. But I think what it is, though, all the women that he's getting are the ones that want that bad boy.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of girls seem to want that when they're younger. Sure. So he sees a good girl. For some reason, I always think she kind of looks like Selena Gomez or something.
She does.
Right? But she's a little bit more approachable. She doesn't have such a deep, raspy voice. Yeah. You know, she's kind of cute. And he approaches her because she sees him. And he's good looking.
Yeah.
But it's weird because this section of the, I was watching it, it reminds me very much of a 50s movie because he's got that sundae with the cherry on top. That doesn't seem very reminiscent of an early 90s. It seems very, they're in that diner. It just seems like Grease or something's going on. And the girls are even there. And it even has that old school song that's going on.
Yes. I don't remember the title, but yeah, it is a 50s song.
Yeah. It's by the Supremes, I think, maybe. So it's like, it's just very 50s-esque, and he even looks kind of James Dean 50s, 60s.
At this point, yeah.
Yeah.
Sitting in the corner, slouched, sort of in his booth, eating a milkshake by himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was trying to be very 50s. And so fast forward, they hit it off, and we see that he's wanting to take this relationship a little more seriously than most of what he's been through. But this girl ends up being the daughter of Thomas Jane's sheriff character.
Yes. So, that's why she's a good girl. She's but you know what? I want to go into that because I think what I like about that is that both Hunter and Michaela are looking for something different. They're not looking for something that they usually get.
Yeah, because even we said that earlier. Yeah,
even Maya, like the girl that Hunter's kind of pining for, I don't think he knows that's the daughter yet either.
Oh, right.
He just like is into her and he like approaches her and she's like, you don't know the first thing about me.
Right.
Well, first she says, like, I have a boyfriend. He's like, no, you don't. But if you keep looking that cute,
you
won't.
Will.
Yeah. And so you don't know the first thing about me. And then he's like, I know you like ketchup, because she's obviously got all this ketchup on her fries.
There are a lot of suave lines in this movie that had I seen this in high school, I would have been using to my advantage.
So if you're young, watch this movie.
Yeah, there's a suaveness.
Up your game.
And also, you, if you're young, you'll get to see a different perspective of what life was like for young people, because it's something that we don't have any gauge for right now, is what it's like to be in high school and sort of navigating all that. I laugh about it and sort of criticize it to a certain degree about the whole, you know, Tinder lifestyle and swiping left and
so
right.
So glad I'm not there, dude.
Speed dating. Never had a speed date in my life.
Yeah.
Never online dated in my life. I just don't know what that feels like. And this is a movie that is grounded and cemented in a world where none of that is possible. And so it is again,
it's all by chance.
Yes, it's all serendipitous to a certain degree. We'll get to serendipity when we talk about our favorite holiday movies, not Hollywood movies.
Christmas movies.
Yeah, Christmas movies.
But,
coming
you know, I prefer that. I often tell people, you know, and I'm not knocking people that actually find their husbands and wives that way, like through the internet, and I'm glad that they can do that if that's what they need.
It's all algorithm-based,
though. But what happened to the stories? Like, what? Yeah. Like, we need, and that's what it's cool about this is that you have a story how they met. It seems like it was fate that's going on here, and I like that, man. And so with the Maya's character, I think Hunter was looking. It almost validates that he's not the bad, crappy. But
it's
she's
the softer side.
Yeah,
she's bringing out the human side of him.
But yeah, but the whole point is that she validates because she's such a good. She's such a good person.
I'm showing you the time here because this is hot summer nights and we're teetering on falling down territory.
No, sorry, man.
It's great. I love it.
But she, like I said, because of what he thought he could never have, somebody that's like there with her, like preppy upbringing, and she's intelligent, she's going places, and like. I don't think he feels like he deserves that because everybody tells him he's bad. And so
that's where some of the strongest relationships come from, is that dynamic of people. And I mean, that's why the old adage, opposites attract, it's not necessarily on a physical level, it's on an emotional level. And in order to become more of a person and just sort of gain a little bit of insight in life, you have to meet people that are not like you and that are coming from different backgrounds and have different stories to tell, so that you can engage with them on a consistent basis and they can add to who you are as a person. And so that you're you're definitely you're challenging yourself to learn new parts of who you are and can unlock. And that's what Hunter is at the point in this movie where he's willing to do that with his relationships and this girl who
changes him.
He
wants more.
He gravitates to that, and he becomes addicted to it, for lack of a better term. He becomes attached to that feeling, and that's what
love.
That's what first love feels like, and this is probably his first love.
I think so. Yeah, he's had his fill of women, and this one's different.
And isn't it interesting that Daniel's character thinks that he's in his first love phase, and arguably, I guess he could be, but it's also puppy love. It's like different. This movie does an interesting job of tackling. What's the age difference between Hunter and Daniel? three or four years?
Probably a couple of years, because I think Hunter's not in high school.
I'm going to say.
But definitely Daniel's old enough to drive since he's got the Corvette. So at least there, but like
18 and 22. He's with his little sister. I want to say 18 and 22. So this movie, actually, Beneath the Layer, this is what we do here on the Film Room, is we...
onion layering.
Yeah.
Awesome blossom.
Beneath that surface layer, this movie's talking about our different approaches to love at different ages in youth. Yeah. And I think Daniel is puppy love with Michaela, and Hunter is past the puppy love stage that he's probably experienced in another movie, and he's at the point where he's ready for something different, and he's had his playa days, and he's past that.
I feel like Daniel really is in love.
You think so?
I personally think so. I don't think it's puppy
love.
This
isn't a rebound from his dad passing and him having
I think she is, like I said, both of these relationships are very, I can see where people would think this is cliche, because then you have the womanizer that finds the woman that changes him. You have the introvert that the sexy mystique woman
brings
the drug dealer rebel
out of him.
Yeah. So it's like, I think he really is in love. Honestly, I do think so. Okay. I always find it kind of dangerous to say puppy love, because I feel like young people really do fall in love.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like very hard. And I think he does too. It's just that he is, on this, I think it, they don't make it, apparent all the time. You really have to think about it. But I think what they were trying to say in the beginning is that the reason why Daniel's doing all this is because of his father's death.
Yeah, it's rebellious.
Yeah, he starts doing these crazy things.
Yes.
And so, but it pays off. So he gets addicted to it.
It pays off to a certain point.
Yeah, so he thinks he can get away with it every time. He thinks he's smarter than the situation. And with her, though, I think he really is in love, because there's a lot of scenes
in
there.
That's fair. Yeah, that, I'm on the fence about it.
Yeah, because you see both of the relationships at one point. It's one of my favorite, whole sections of the movie where they come in with this song. It's called The Hospital by the Modern Lovers, and it's a great song, and you see them breaking into a bar, and she's like drinking from the bar thing, and they're dancing in the parking lot. And honestly, I've had that kind of romance where I was dancing in the parking lot at night just randomly. And also you see Hunter at the fair, and they're taking the pictures in the photo booth, and he doesn't want to, but it's like, it's just like real love. And then the guys bump into her, and they're like, what up? Like those guys that are, and he gets this like
urge to go back to his physical ways. But she tempers him.
Yeah, she's like, I know something better.
Yeah.
And then they go and you assume they have sex after that.
That's where about 20 to 30 minutes of the film take place, is showing the back and forth of how these relationships are developing. And I don't want to give away, I don't want to get to the breakdown of the ending here, because I do want to leave that part we can talk about it briefly, because this whole time they're still amassing tons of money, and even more money from their drug dealing. And also there's this hurricane bearing down on the East Coast that we mentioned at the beginning. It wasn't present at the beginning at all.
Actually at the very beginning.
Yeah, because the first scene is Timothy Chalamet's
driving
GTA 2 style through the cities of Hyannis, and you're like, why is this happening? What's going on? And then it's a flashback, and everything is sort of leading up to that point.
It's a hook.
Yeah, it is a hook. So the intensification of their drug game and their business is happening this whole time, that their intensification of the real people behind all of this is taking shape as well. So it's very interesting dynamic, because shit's getting pretty serious with their weed selling.
Yeah, because he's like, he goes into the shower of Hunter Strawberry. Like, he's like, guess how much we made? And he's like, how much? 100? He's like, up.
He's
like, what more? He's like, shut up. 250,000.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, that's some serious dough back
off
then.
Off of weed, too. Which is, I don't know the authenticity of all that, but it is what it is.
Yeah, we don't know. We're not drug
dealers. We can't break down we can't break down the numbers. Edit this out.
Somebody could do the math, I'm sure.
Edit this out.
I mean, there's probably enough information in algebra that you can probably find out the X.
Yes.
But you start seeing the Polaroids when they're like getting drunk,
and
they're like, and then they draw a penis on Daniel's face as he's throwing up. I found that very realistic, because I think when you're partying and if you had a lot of money like that, you'd probably get so drunk and throw up, and it's not flattering. That's what I like about it. It's not like trying to make it look. I mean, there's a Polaroid you see of Daniel just throwing up, mid-throwing up. Yeah. It looks disgusting.
Yeah.
But it's that's exactly what would probably it be. I mean, the Polaroids, everything. And then we actually skipped a couple of parts where Daniel gets kisses at the fair. He kisses Micah Monroe's character.
Oh, yeah.
He has a moment where he's gives her Epsom salt at the fair with her friends around her.
Yeah, the first
she's
kiss.
With her boyfriend. And then he leaving... And he's going to do the, he has an inhaler, so we forgot to mention that.
That's
he's
okay.
kind of sickly.
Yeah.
And he throws it away, and he goes back and kisses her, and then the guy punches him, and he gets knocked out.
Yeah.
And you see the fireworks.
Cliche.
Yeah, and then you hear Hunter saying, did you hear somebody kiss my baby sister?
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to make sure he can't be with anyone.
Because there's that subplot of the whole, you know, brother, sister thing that he's trying to tread very carefully, and he's worried about all the stories being true that Hunter's going to really hurt him if he finds out that that him and his sister have a thing going on.
And it's funny, too, that scene because they're eating clams.
Yeah.
And the girl serving them clams is the girl that, from the beginning, hates Hunter. Like, they interview and she's like, bad.
Oh, you know?
And then she throws the clams on the thing. And she's also the friend of Maya's. She's at the table and she looks at him like all ugly, like she hates him.
That's something only someone who's seen this movie 15 little things like that will pick up on.
It's funny though, and she has her hair crimped and everything, like 80s style. It's funny, but yeah. So that whole thing happens, and then he sees. That's when we were talking about Terminator 2. They're watching it again, and he has to go pee really bad, and he sees the character, and she's like, "I can't believe you just kiss. You can't just go up and kiss people." And her friend spits her gum in his. You know, a chest.
But deep down inside, she wanted that to happen as well.
Yeah, well,
she's probably expecting it.
Yeah, well, she goes into the restroom when he's going to use the restroom.
Right.
And I assume he has his penis in his hands because he unzips his fine. He's about to use the restroom in the urinal. And she comes in and starts kissing him hard. And he falls into the urinal a little bit. So it's like a little...
It's a pretty imposing situation for an 18-year-old kid to be in.
Actually, she slaps him first. She slaps him and then kisses him. So it's like she is taking control again. Like she... It's a good scene because it's not normal. It's like really weird.
Yes.
But it's good. And so all this happens and like you start seeing that they're both in these relationships. And I love the whole scene where they drive out into the field and it starts hailing and there's a song and they have sex for the first time because the whole thing about the story is he's like, you've never had sex before. Like he just, cause she says it's their first time or something like that. You get the feeling that she hasn't had sex and she's like, no. And so they have sex for the first time.
She's separating herself from all the stereotypes and the lore and the story.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole point. These two mysterious characters are totally misunderstood by everybody around them.
Yeah.
And that's why Daniel is kind of like this person that doesn't know these stories and just kind of sees them for who they are, and they love that about him. So, again, all this stuff is happening, and it's all coming to a head here.
And they're
still
hustling, and that's intensifying. And then we get a glimpse of the power, sort of the need for more that Daniel has about him that's different from Hunter, because Hunter would have been happy selling dimes and nickels to the townsfolk for another summer.
Because he knows better. He knows once you're in, you can't get out. Like, he knows it's going to end badly.
Yeah.
He already kind of accepted it, I believe. So I think this third act that we're getting into is where a lot
of
people have a lot
of... touch on this because let's just have at it.
Yeah, let's go in because, again, this is where I think most people have a problem. And truthfully, I do too a little bit. I feel like it's very rushed, the third act.
It is.
It just escalates very, very quickly. Yeah. And I feel like maybe there was more and they just had to edit it out.
William Fichtner, who's a really outstanding actor... still puts his foot down and
this is where Daniel
wants more.
Yeah, he
wants
has a
to
conversation
graduate.
With Hunter.
Yep.
And Hunter's like, don't do this.
He
man.
Wants to graduate up from weed and he
go
wants
to cocaine.
Access to cocaine. And in order to do that, he has to branch out from Dex as the supplier because, well, up to this point, Dex is just weed only, I guess.
Yeah, he goes to Portland, Maine, I believe.
Yeah, he goes to Portland, Maine, and he's brought into this house with William Fichtner, who's a great character actor.
Yeah. And he does this behind Hunter's back, by the way.
Yes.
Hunter is like, don't do this. Dex will find out, and he will find out, and things are going
to
go bad.
And the guy on the couch is actually the director.
Yes, I was about to say that Elijah Bynum is the guy on the couch that just looks freaking coked out of his mind. Yeah,
but turns out he's not, because all of that was a ruse, and it's not even cocaine.
There's a naked girl in the back playing piano pieces. It's very druggy.
She looks very Harley Quinn-esque, or sort of not Harley Quinn. She reminded me of from the first Batman, Joker's girls.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the sort That's of true. Controlled, puppeted sort of women in William Fisher's life, because he's just this big drug kingpin, and he has this sort of ugliness about the world around him.
It's very drug den-ish.
Yeah, like, it is drug den-ish.
Like somewhere, like it looked like you'd be in a just squatting in this house that has like these cool lights in it. It just it's a weird put together house. It's like a college kid's house almost. Nothing's on the walls, and he's like going. He's just so again calm because he has control of the situation.
Yeah,
because when you find out is that he already knew that this kid was with happen. Dex. He knows Dex, and he's like. So he gives the kid, he gives Daniel some coke to try. And Daniel's like, oh, yeah, it's good stuff. But he's like, it's baby powder.
Yeah,
but like, this is, he tells him that after he accepts the money for it.
Yep.
He's like, listen, kid, that's baby powder. And I'm going to rob you. I'm going to take this money. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yep.
And I'm not going to kill you, because basically when Dex finds out, he's going to do it for me.
Get it. Yep.
And like that's when Daniel knows he messed up, like really hard.
And then that's when the last 15 to 20 minutes of this movie are such a stark departure from what I was expecting it to become.
No more good times.
I kind of like and dislike that at the same time, because if it had verged on this path sooner at the halfway point, then I would have been cool with it. But I knew it was going to happen eventually, because you have this whole ominous detail that this large hurricane is approaching the coast. And that's a symbolization of the impending sort of drama and disaster that this situation is leading up towards, because it's the physical convergence of that hurricane versus where the plot line's going. They all come to a head here in the last 20 minutes. And then everything gets derailed, and all of this hard work and effort that was put into the relationships,
it's just wiped out.
Just wiped out very quickly, like a hurricane comes through and just knocks everything down.
And like you said, I like it and I don't like it, because the feel of the movie in the beginning feels like this, like it could have been like this coming of age classic, like a Breakfast Club almost, or something like that of that sort. But then the last half or the last act, it completely takes
it's the ugly side.
It just.
Of what
all of that
this can be.
Yeah, and I wonder if they had more there. Like, I really wish if they would have elongated that, like if they would have had more, I think it would have been more digestible. Mm-hmm. Because we kind of skipped a little bit about Hunter's story, because the sheriff finds out.
Yeah, they have a heart-to-heart.
You find out that the sheriff was best friends with his father, and his father was like the same thing as Hunter. He's like this good-looking, could take anything, but I think he said he took the fall. For both, I think they were both doing bad, and he went to jail.
Yeah, and the other one became a sheriff.
Yeah, they branched off very, you know. So you get this feeling that Thomas Jane's character is not bad. He just knows.
Yeah,
and he's trying to help Hunter get out of the game. And Hunter's like, "Well, what do you think this is going to do? You think this is going to change anything?"
Right.
Because Hunter knows that this is all going to go bad. He's already on the path.
Yeah.
As soon as he accepted the deal with Dex.
But it goes so bad.
Yes.
It goes bad to the point where, like, the scene with Dex, I was halfway not expecting it, because I liked the Dex character. And I was like, there's no way this is going to happen. I won't get into the details of what happens, just in case there's some people still listening that are completely...
We ruin it for everybody. Let's go.
All right. So Dex shows up at the mechanic shop after he
calls Daniel. Yeah. And he says, you broke my heart.
Yeah,
and just hangs up. And he knows.
And he confronts Hunter at the mechanic shop looking for Daniel. And then it's not even a showdown. Because
Hunter resigns. He knows.
To what?
But see, that's the thing. So, like, the first thing that Hunter tells him at that table, like, if you do this, don't come running to me.
Yeah.
And he does. He goes, he's like, oh, he's going to kill me. He's like, and Hunter has the gun pointed towards Timothy Chalamet's character, and he doesn't shoot him.
Oh,
I think he makes that decision because he wanted to, and he decides to be a better person. And that's the thing. I think that's what Maya changed him, the violence in him. And that's why Dex tells him.
And he's his sister to a certain degree, too. Because
yes, because he goes to her.
We forgot that part. Yep.
And he wants to make amends.
Yeah, so he does make amends with all, even himself, and he reconciles all of the trauma that he put to the side that this new relationship brought some out of him. But the only part that I just think could have been completely rewritten was the Hunter death scene.
Because I liked Hunter so much that I felt like that was almost a waste.
It was undeserved.
Yeah, like he was the only one that I felt like Timothy Chalamet's character deserved that. He's the one that put him there. And even Dex was like, this is not the time to be proud. And it's just that he doesn't know.
That sort of dramatic scene, even the back and forth that Dex and Hunter have before Dex shoots him, it didn't feel as if...
Right.
It didn't feel right.
It didn't feel like it was Hunter's character.
The dialogue. Yeah. There was probably some subplot left out of the Hunter story, maybe, that would have made that feel right. Like, if it had been from the party scene in Boston where he beats that guy up... If that attitude had maintained itself and like the bad guy side of Hunter was fleshed out a little more, and the whole like, oh, this guy is kind of a scummy physical sort of working his way up enforcer type. Maybe if that had sustained, I could see this last scene making sense, but it didn't. And we got the soft side of Hunter like we've thoroughly gotten into here.
I think they tried to prepare us because even Dex was like, you knew this was going to happen. Didn't you? He said, you knew the whole time. And like Hunter doesn't say anything. And he's like, well, and then he just pulls out his gun and
Hunter Strawberry, such a dynamic name in itself.
I know, right?
Hunter and then Strawberry is like, you know, soft, fruity.
Yeah. Pitcher, you know, Daryl Strawberry.
Yeah. Daryl Strawberry.
But, you know, I feel like I just felt like I think a lot of people feel this, that it's like, what? That was it. Like Hunter's kind of like we looked up to Hunter. We knew he's a good guy. He's coming around. He's trying to help Timothy's character. And Timothy's so selfish. He comes to there. Oh, and at that point when he goes there and it's raining, Michaela shows up.
Yeah.
And then she knows. She sees her brother dead. Well, no. She sees Timothy Chalamet and her brother, and she knows that they've been drug dealing.
They've known each other.
Because she doesn't want anything to do with that. And so that's
another factor. Because we skipped the arcade scene.
Yeah, and we also, you know.
But that's okay.
Yeah, her whole character is that she doesn't want to be with somebody like that. And
right.
And Daniel is really trying to keep that from her, and that's when it all comes ahead. And he runs after her, you know, and that's when he gets in a wreck, when he's driving. Trying to get out of Dodge, basically, and he has to.
So this is where the based as we're talking more about this, the based on a true story kinda, and this is where the narrator, 13-year-old, comes into play. And this is the optimistic point of view that I took after watching this movie. I've only seen it once, and I will watch it again, and I'll try to break down what I'm about to say even more after multiple viewings. But maybe. Maybe, just maybe, the sensationalization of the story from the 13-year-old's point of view is all of this sort of fictitiousness because that crash scene should have killed Daniel. It was a pretty serious crash. He gets T-boned and he does multiple flips and then he just gets up, walks out, and makes it to
Michaela's
without
house.
A broken bone. So maybe this is all... the 13-year-old's rendition of this story, much like
from here on out, I think.
Yeah, much like the personas and the personalities of all these characters, we were introduced from a 13-year-old's perspective as being, you know, larger than life in every aspect, from Michaela to Hunter to the whole tone of what's going on. So if you, I mean, deep diving is allowed here. This is a safe place for deep diving.
You're in a safe place.
Yes. So if I'm deep diving it, maybe all of this is the part of the story that's not true, and that it's all like hyperbole for what wouldn't have made as good of a movie, but what actually happened. It's just so sensationalized. It's so much drama in the last 30 minutes.
Well, I have to think because the kid actually lives across the street and from the gas station that Hunter works at.
And all he sees is
the dead body and Michaela.
The dead body and Michaela leaving.
Yes.
So the rest of the story is him putting it all together from his perspective, and that's why he's the narrator from start to finish, is because I open saying this is sort of like Memento. The kid could have seen that Mm-hmm. And then we have to hear the story of how everything got to that point from this 13-year-old's point of view.
Yeah, and I can get with that because the whole thing is left a little open-ended because it's like A24 they're never seen too. Again.
This isn't an A24 movie without that element.
Yeah, it's very like they were never seen again. Michaela was last seen getting on a bus to wherever. And I guess
some people say she became a big Hollywood starlet, and some people say, there's a lot of that, like maybe this happened, maybe that happened.
Mm-hmm. But for sure, Hunter's dead. Yes. And that's what I was like, oh, like, man, I really liked Hunter. And I wouldn't say he's innocent, but it's like he was not trying to get into the cocaine game. And he's the only one that got punished for it.
Yeah.
He's the one that caught that, you know? And I don't know what happened I just felt like, did we really have to kill Hunter like that?
No.
I mean, if he was going to die, I felt like it should have been in a different way. I just felt like it wasn't right. And I think that's where a lot of people, like, at the end, and I've talked to, you know, real people out here, like real friends, and they were like, yeah, I just didn't like the ending.
Yeah.
Everything else was great. So I can definitely get behind that if that's how you feel. I can understand that perspective. But honestly, I'm kind of glad that they went with not such a happy ending, because we sometimes always assume that that's going to happen. And I think that's where a lot of critics are like, oh, I didn't like this movie, because that's what they were wanting.
Yeah.
Or that's what they were expecting.
That's what it all led up to as well. I mean, there is the karma factor, and everything up to this point that these kids were doing
was fun fantasy.
Fantasy, but had ramifications as well in the real world. So, maybe infusing a sense of the repercussions that need to be faced for all of this adds a bit of like, okay, now everybody who's seen this movie, don't go out and start selling weed and thinking that you're going to be a big shot, because ultimately you'll end up in these shoes. And there's some merit to that. I've never met anyone in my life that I've known that has gotten away with stuff like that, with something that is bad. Selling drugs is, I mean, if you're doing it to...
We all seen, like, you know, the shows about Pablo Escobar, the movies. The best you can do is get to the top, and it's still going to end bad.
Yes.
You get it for a short while.
So at least this movie was honed in there, and it realized that even though all this fantasy and this sort of summertime love and hot summer nights, the name of the movie itself.
Yeah, that's what, actually, we forgot to, that Dex said that. He's like, it'll sell like a cherry ice on a hot summer night.
Yeah.
The way he says it, too. It's like, usually I hate it when they say the title in the movie.
Yeah, Dex's character's at the top of the hierarchy for me in this movie. I just love that guy, man. He was great. And so how would you overall, who was your favorite character in this film?
Well, I really liked Hunter the most, but I had more common ground with Daniel's character.
Did you?
Except for the, and I think that's another reason, is just like, why did he want to sell cocaine? Like, why? Like,
he wanted more. That's what
it just seemed. Yeah. I know he wanted more, but I don't feel like they made that like a running theme.
They
didn't.
Know?
It was like a little part, and you were expected to keep that in your consciousness, but it's like a lot of that is forgotten because it's so ADD. Like, you're like, okay, next night, the romance, and you're kind of like sucked into the romance, a little bit about the dealer and all that stuff. There's so much going on in this movie that it's hard to pinpoint this as like, what is this movie?
Right.
Because it's like, you could say it's cliche, but is it really? No.
No.
And that's probably the reason why a lot of people didn't like it.
I don't think A24 picks this up if it's cliche, because... Yeah.
Well,
if
why did
it
they pick
is
it up in the first place?
Exactly.
If they didn't,
that's
if they're not
the whole
market
psychology
it.
Of it is like A24 is not looking for feel good sort of summertime coming of age story. There's got to be those layers to it for it to be on their radar.
It.
And there is definitely the edge. And
I think if you're prepared or if you're just completely open minded, you're going to like this, because I think the opening kind of sets you up to not expect those things.
Yeah.
And that violence, it's super violent and it's jarring. I think that's what it is that
it's like, an R-rated license to drive weird science and sort of like Buddy Sandlot coming of age hybrid.
Yeah, it's very nostalgic. And
yes.
I think a lot of people are going to latch on to the nostalgia. the soundtrack. I think the cinematography is just top notch, man. The way they light stuff, and I just, there's so much color, you know, and
that
I love
Ferris
that.
Wheel scene.
Oh,
or
yeah,
the,
yeah. In the background. Yeah, in it's the background. Just beautiful to me. And it, yet it still seems very real, like even the copper tones of the night. And I've always loved that. We kind of, you know, if you're growing up today, you don't really get those copper tones anymore. Nope. It's like all LED lights. But back when I was growing up, I loved that feel. And so they bring that back. And I think that's, and I guess you could say a lot of people didn't like the editing. I could see where you didn't, because it is
choppy, ADD, and
spontaneous.
Yeah, it is spontaneous, but I think that serves a purpose for the tone of the story is very spontaneous. And if Daniel's our main protagonist, he's very spontaneous and he's very rebellious, and you don't know. And there's a certain point where you don't know how far he's willing to take this, because he's just completely enthralled with this lifestyle. Now that he's rebelled against his docile sort of
passiveness.
Yeah, his passiveness in the first phase of his life. And there's merit there. Like, once you break through to that whole, once you break past that whole high school mentality or that introvert lifestyle that we've all been through, you sort of become latched on to the rebellious sort of like, okay,
it's a drug, man.
Yeah, it is. It is a drug.
Yeah. When you start getting rewarded for anything, you're going to continue doing it. It's just psychology. So, I mean, I guess that's the one thing I felt like, because the first viewing, I didn't understand why Daniel wanted to do cocaine when everything was going so great. It's like, why did you want more? Why did you get greedy? Why? It just didn't feel right. And
he didn't know what the potential was. And that's kind of what it is. That's the dangers of anything.
Yeah, he's naive. Definitely he's naive, and he thinks everything's always going to work out.
Yep.
And I feel like they just if they would have put more clues along the way to continue that thread in Daniel's life, that he needed more. And like they even said in the beginning, he's like, you know, I don't know what happened in Danny, what made him snap, you know, after his father's death. So that's the only indication of, you know, that this guy is needing more in life. And Hunter is the first one that's the catalyst that brings everything, the romance that he gets, the money from the weed, you know. And
well, there's also that nothing to lose element about Daniel. Like, at the end of the day, what does he have to lose? We didn't get a really strong mother and son sort of vibe. So this kid was going to live with his aunt for the summer. He may have just tried to, live his life in a 3-month window to his fullest of his capabilities.
It's true, but at the end, he does have so much to lose.
Yeah,
he has all the money. He gets
robbed. He has no gauge for it. Yeah. He has no idea how much he has to lose.
He loses his car, his money, his girl, his best friend. He loses everything.
That's why we hate the movie, because we get, or I'm sorry, not hate the movie, hate the ending, because we get what Daniel didn't, and we have the ability to step back and remove ourselves from what's going on in this character. And we can say, oh, dude, put the brakes on here. Do not go to Portland, Maine. Do not. We can play the Hunter Strawberry role and say, don't do any of this. You got it good. But then again, there's no movie without the escalation of this taking a left turn.
And I do want to say, man, like Elijah Bynum, man, this was a great movie, dude. Like,
it was, man.
I think there is only, it's not all that stuff that we're talking about, the negative stuff, is not enough for me to not like the movie.
It made $250,000 at the box office. I'm sure the budget was higher than that based on the actors alone.
That's another thing. The actors were superb.
Yes.
Acting's
top notch. And all of the people involved in this movie, as far as the crew's concerned, they all played their role very well, from the soundtrack to the cinematography and the supporting actors, the big names who onboarded a small project like this, like Thomas Jane, William Fichtner, and these folks who got involved, they saw something in that script that was special. And it is a special movie. It could have been something really special if the last 30 minutes were spent a little bit more time with them, and maybe even set up for a continuation of the story. Even then, I don't know.
I think that's the bone to pick with most people, is that this movie could have been super great.
Yeah, could have been something we're talking about in 20, 30 years.
Yeah, but instead it's more like a, for me, it's like a time maybe capsule. 7.5 at the least on a 10 scale to maybe 9, somewhere in between.
Maybe, yeah.
It's not going to be like The Breakfast Club, you know, that you can watch and it extends kind of time because a lot of teenagers feel like that. And it's because of the ending. You really have to kind of accept that kind of niche. It's almost like a weird subcategory that nobody's even thought of, you know? But I really do feel like Elijah Bynum, don't get discouraged on this, man, because that was a really good attempt for your first time directing.
Oh, yeah.
And he is really just a writer. In fact, he wrote this movie, wrote this script a while back ago, just as kind of like to get a job. And the script made its rounds. And it was on the blacklist, which is like basically the greatest scripts that are not being made right now because nobody can make them. And he decided to do it himself. And so they got a stellar, I don't know how he got the stellar cast together and all this stuff, how it all came to be, because it seems like he had everything at his disposal to make this the best. Because obviously people had to have believed in the script. It must have been that good to get all these actors to sign on.
Some of them big names.
Yeah, and A20, but I don't get why A24 picked it up if they weren't going to push it in some way. Like, I've never even heard of this movie, to be honest. Never even seen a preview.
Amazon Prime, which is an important note here, if anybody wants to check this out, it's kind of only available on Amazon Prime from streaming, and there's a Blu-ray release of it. But you're not going to hear about it unless somebody tells you, go see this movie.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if A24 is like trying to put this in the basement, like don't put this on our books because we have this stellar, you know, cast lineup of movies that are just great, Academy Award nominated, and they don't want people to see this ugly redheaded stepchild in the basement or something. Like, dude, what?
But
I love this redheaded stepchild. This is true stuff. Like, I really enjoyed it. Just like Under the Silver Lake. Like, what is with A24 and trying to hide this from people?
Well, they're very hit or miss with me. Like, some of the stuff that gets pushed in my face from A24 is some of the stuff that I'm just not crazy about. There's a recent Robert Pattinson movie where he's in space and High Life.
I really did not like that movie.
Didn't like it at all.
Neither did my wife.
And from the onset, that was one of the movies I was hyped for.
Me too.
Yeah.
I like the French director.
It's like the
she
stuff
awesome.
They promote is the letdown. Hereditary, to a certain degree, I was let down a little bit.
Me too.
Then Midsommar did not get the big push. And Midsommar,
I didn't see that one yet.
That one was through the roof for me. It's interesting because they got a big movie coming out here on Christmas Day with Adam Sandler. Uncut Gems, where
he wants to get nominated for an Academy Award.
He's
going
hard for it. And this movie is being promoted hard by A24. Like, this could be their biggest opening weekend period of all time because it's such a departure for Adam Sandler. He's definitely going for an Oscar. But I don't know. I'm hesitant. However, it is giving me it's giving me the vibes of Good Time with Robert Pattinson from 3 or 4 years ago. A24 again. That movie knocked the socks off of me. Maybe you can watch that at some point in the next couple of months and we could talk about Good Time, because that is A24's hit or miss. But I do appreciate what they do in the larger scope of cinema right now, because we don't get this movie. It's blacklisted, and it stays there unless A24 picks it up.
No, you're right. I mean, it's either A24 or Netflix at this point, or Focus.
Yeah.
So those are the three ones that if you're like really into original, you know, weird stories and stuff, not the big franchise movies that have to make $100 million or they bust.
Yep.
That's where we're at now. It's a different era in time, because this is the golden era of TV, I think. So
yes.
Everything, if you're going to make a love story, there's no more $40 million movies being made in the theater.
Nah.
It's all like Netflix now. That's what they're spending on their TV shows and movies. So, but man, this movie was so good that I've been telling everybody about it. And again, some people don't like it. And like I said, I can't find any critics. I've only found like two people that gave it like, okay, you know, but man,
well, the whole new wave of kids that can't relate to what's going on in the movie are also going to shit on it as well.
Yeah, and maybe that's kind of what they were trying to market to, but it wasn't the audience.
Yeah.
When really, it should be marketed to 30-year-olds that kind of grew
that
up
have been
that
through
era.
This sort of thing. Yeah, and that's a marketing misstep, and maybe Maybe we can see A24 sort of tap into that, because their audiences are kind of all over the place, but there are a lot of folks our age who had the experience of independent movies in the late 90s and early 2000s, and then in the last 10 years have seen that completely dwindled by big Hollywood, who's come in and sort of, you know, laid down these $100 million movies left and right. And you got to seek it. You got to seek out the small budget, great story, memorable movie now. And A24 is sort of the middleman to all this. This could all be a story of how A24 came about too, if you look at it very strangely. Well, A24 is pretty much Daniel's character. They started off small time. They got into the weed game, and now they're going for that yayo. And now they may be losing their step a little bit because.
Well, that Uncut Gems will be the one that makes or breaks them.
Uncut Gems will be interesting. Yep.
So, but again, we're going to wrap this up because, well,
we've been going on this for 4.5 hours.
Yeah, something like that. But I mean, truly, guys, give this a shot. Be open minded. Yeah. If you listen to this beforehand, you're kind of going to be more prepared. And I'm sorry that, you know, you might not be surprised, but I think it prepares you to like the movie even more.
Oh yeah,
because it's those jarring surprises, I think, is what put people off.
Yep.
And also that rushed third act, but it's not enough for me to dislike this movie. I've been obsessed with it, and it's probably because of my bias of the upbringing, the location, the great acting. Like I said, everything that we said, and the soundtrack. Check it out, man. Yeah. It is all put together. I mean, you got the zombies on there. You got a lot of people that I didn't even know.
Yeah.
So, man, I can't say enough good stuff about
Timmy
it.
Timmy T, one more try. Just play it right now. Yeah. You'll be listening to it all day.
Timmy T is on a Timmy C movie. All right. Yeah. See you later, guys.